members there is a DG department officer. We were still listening to the responses from the CMG.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to ask one of the governing body members who would like to add.
Honourable Madisha, did you want? Are you here? Are you there? Did you want to raise this question now? Is it related to to the responses that are given? Is it the follow-up question? Okay.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much. I'm not to the responses as the CCMA here where you must respond clearly. I want to say to this bit that it's a very important strategy given what they have been able to do since we established them until now. I know in the country, I don't think it's a follow-up, Chair. Although we contest the unemployment rate, it is a fact that it is extremely high. I know the summer thing is 40%, summer thing is lower than that, etc. But it's a fact that it is extremely high. And they got to play a major role in so far as that is concerned. And we shall make a proposal, Chairperson. Now, the issue of venues, if one were to start there, has been raised to say you can't talk of only 21 venues, you know, around the country. But again, related to that, we should talk about the budget. Do they have enough money, etc., etc.? They must, you know, clarify that so that ourselves as we go on to discuss and come up with, you know, a proper way forward, we should be able to look into that. I hear they did speak of the budget, etc. But then, as this body, we must be able to say to them, this route has got to be followed, etc., etc., etc. Come and give us the report. Now, I was just checking elsewhere, and you know, to make a follow-up to what the chairperson and, of course, other members here raised. This issue of the venues, I checked somewhere, and you know, those of us who are unlucky, who participated in the trade union movement at some stage in the past, not for long, but for only 25 years, know that if you've got to go and have CCMA come in, etc., etc., he does not go here to only one venue that will be there in Gauteng. Okay, he does not go to only one venue that is there in Limpopo. Albeit there may be two venues, for example, in the Western Cape, or three venues in Gauteng. One has been able to you know, find out that when they go to negotiate, when they go to assist, etc., they use other institutions. Not institutions, I mean, yes, what do you call the thing? The Department of Labor offices, etc., etc., you know, all over the country. So, can they take this forward, really, to explain? As I'm saying, in Gauteng, where we have the highest number of workers, we will have a problem. CG, through you, our leader, you have millions of people that work. And obviously, if they are referring to CCMA, were to say, okay, we have 100 offices here, it still may not be feasible for them country who have a problem are actually assisted. I mean, we are a team, I wish to believe. They are not there just as the employees, they are there as the people who, of course, have got to be given direction by ourselves, as the, you know, the committee, but they must report as well. Yes, I agree. So yes, you have, you, I'm referring to CCMA, you have this offices. I think only few because of the budget. Secondly, are you using properly the other offices as you move around the country? And I'm saying the little experience that some of us have is that they will go to the offices of labor department, they will go to these other offices, etc., etc. So if that could be further clarified, unless you know, the opposite now, you know, has grown. The second thing, I would want to know from the CCMA, yes, we know that the primary objective is to bring together employer, employee, problems, rather parties to deal with the problems that are there. Okay? But then, this thing that has been raised, I believe it has not been explained properly. The intra-union rivalries have today risen very high beyond the employer-employee problems which are there. So CCMA, in my understanding, will bring the employer and the employee, say, sit down, let's deal with this problem. But then, for the reason that has got to be the case, the opposite, in very many instances, has now begun to rise, where those who have a problem are fighting against each other or against one another, and as a result of that, you have this major problem. Now, I will want to know from them, because yes, this question was raised, but in my own understanding, really, it was not properly responded to. The intra-union rivalry, how do they basically deal with that? It may be difficult, but then at the moment, how have you gone on to deal with that? Are there, if you so believe, are there proposals that we require from ourselves? Because I'm saying intra-rivalry, but then it's not only the unions themselves. You find that the workers, for example, is a member of Union A, but at the same time is a member of Union B, okay, in the free environment. Okay? Now you have the problem. Number one, intra-unions, Union A and B, organizing in the same institution. But then secondly, you have these poor workers not knowing where they got to fall. They are members, a worker is a member of both unions. But then again, 75% of workers are no longer members of unions. Now we have a problem. What is it that you basically are doing to handle that? But just to go back as I end, we are talking here of, say, for example, two offices in the Western Cape. I come from Limpopo, for example, and I can tell you that the workers who travel from Kwandere, okay, on a daily basis, they leave at 3 in the morning to go to work in Johannesburg. And when they arrive there very late, go back very late, arrive at 3 in the at 3:10 in the morning, etc. So we've got to direct where it is, look at the entire country and say, CCMA, what is it that you are doing here so that we can be able to handle this thing? And this thing of, you know, intra-union problems. Madam King, I'm ending. It's now basically a major problem where I believe they won't be able, they can't be able, they cannot really deal with, because very many unions have now become, you know, political vests of the various political parties. Okay, now that's a major problem, and we've got to sit and see how we can handle this. Now, what are your advice? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Matisha. There are questions, follow-up questions from the inputs, I'm sure, as you are speaking, you pretend them down. So as you answer the questions, so you take them into consideration. Thank you very much, Chair.
When we broke, we were talking about various areas of venues and related to that. Mr. Felipe is a member for the governing body from government, but I'd also assist in responding to that question, Chair. And Chair, I'd also like to indicate I have now obtained the list of all the venues in the rest of the year. There's 78. But I thought maybe we could just get it printed out, so if you'd like me to read it out.
Now, are we? The last time we were talking about Gwendolyn that you referred to. And now I don't know where that facility comes from.
Why can't we try to simplify it? I don't understand it. From CCMA, just to say, or to declare that in Kumalang, where I come from, offices are 4 or 5, and here are their addresses. Why should it be a difficult exercise to do this? In Gauteng, here is the slide from Gauteng, their phones and everything else. Because, I mean, you're working with all those contact points every day. It should not be a difficult just to indicate to us here now. And or maybe at lunch when we break, but it should not be a matter which really needs an explanation. Now we're moving from 2 to 78. We're not sure whether the 78 is the operation centers or their offices. So you're bringing a new dimension on the matter. Why should it be a problem just to indicate to us? Here is a list of those offices with contacts and everything, because those are the contact points daily.
Thank you, members. Officials from the CCMA, please, let's just stick to the 21 that you introduced to us in your presentation. Because if you, as my honorable colleague is saying, you open it wider, it's not going to be easy. Maybe you think it will be easy, it will be more difficult. And we want you to stick to what you presented to us and deal with it.
So can you tell? I will ask Mr. Felipe to make the input of your presentation.
Thank you, Mahima. Thank you, members and the chair. The issue of office space for the CCMA, the director has answered it. What I wanted to assist members to try and understand the problem of office space, what's the problem for workers. Now, hearing cases is not a problem. It's already been said here that the CCMA goes where the cases are. They go to church, they go to community halls, they go to schools during the school holidays, they hear cases, it doesn't matter where. The problem is for workers to report their case because as the director said, that here in the city wasn't taken for two offices. You can only report your case in the CCMA office. That's where the problem is. Now, we have a strategy with the CCMA of increasing those offices. Not by putting money into the problem, but by using Department of Labor offices. We've got 126 offices all over the country. There should be no reason why a worker cannot go to the Department of Labor and launch a case, a CCMA case, and that the system of the CCMA links up with the Department of Labor. Just like now, workers can go to certain offices of the Department of Labor and check their cases of the CCMA because that link up is there. The next step now is to make sure that we train Department of Labor officials to be able to capture cases in the system of the CCMA. Then workers in Gugulethu don't have to go to town to launch their case. They can go to the CCMA, to the Department of Labor offices, and launch their case there. And the CCMA can pick it up in the system. That's the project that we've got with the CCMA. My other thing to remember is that the CCMA and the Department of Labor must be held responsible in ensuring that that project succeeds. Because if you succeed in that project, you will have all of a sudden plus 126 offices across the country where workers can go and put in their case, because that's the problem. The problem is not where they go for a case on the case day, because the CCMA go to them. The problem is them launching their case, and the solution to that is that without putting money, because the issue of money is very problematic with the economy as it is. We've got to be smart, try and use other avenues to solve the problem and take services to the people. That's the issue about office and the extension of office of state of the CCMA by using what is already available. The other issue that I wanted to talk about, members, was on the issue of essential services. This question about essential services. The major, major problem, members, about essential services now is this. The law says that there should be service-level agreements. Now, labor, when they negotiate service-level agreements, they want everybody in that service level agreement to go on strike. Business, employers in the processes, be it Eskom, be it any other municipality, business wants nobody to go on strike. They want as little people to go on strike. Labor wants everybody to go on strike. Remember, the service level agreement is there to say who can go on strike and who cannot. It's in the interest of labor that everybody go on strike. It's in the interest of business that nobody go on strike. As a result, they cannot agree. As a result, in the labor market, there's not a single service level agreement, precisely because the parties cannot agree on the numbers, who should go on strike, who should not go on strike. Both of them are greedy. They want 100% of what they want. Now, the negotiation that is in front of the president today is dealing with this issue. The legislation says, if the parties cannot agree, then the essential service committee must decide what is right for the economy and give them the service level agreement. They don't have a choice. And that's the solution that the law is introducing to solve this problem of non-existence of a service level agreement, so that everybody should know if there's a strike at Eskom, who will go on strike, who should not go on strike. As it is now, we do not know. And that's those are the issues. And as soon as the president signed that law into law, the Essential Services Committee should come here in this committee, the chair and his team should come here and tell the members of the parliament how they intended to implement this, what time frame do they need to ensure that in each and every institution where it is declared essential services, there is a service level agreement. And that's the problem with the service level agreement, is that parties cannot agree. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mokubuli. There are two issues that think before I allow the CMA to pass on this issue, which is the essential services and the venues, are we done so that we continue with other questions? Okay, it means we're done. Let me ask the question. Maybe not. Who decided on the location of this 21? Is it the offices here in the provinces who give you guidelines as to where the office should be, and do they motivate? You know, for me that question is important because the question of the Western Cape for me is a problem. You can't have our people suffer at W. I hear that Mr. Mkululi is saying, and you were saying yesterday, that you are not talking about the cases, because the cases, you go where people are. But before there's a case, people must report. And then people must have money. And those workers who always go and report the employer to the CMA are the most vulnerable workers. And they reside in Mitchell's Plain, in Delft. Even your office that is here in the Western Cape, that is in the township, it is in Nyanga. It is not accessible because people, the station in Nyanga, those people are coming from Khayelitsha, they must go down, and the Nyanga station is here in Kukuletu, here it's in Nyanga. But the station is right here in Kukuletu, next to Hegefeld, that's where it is. So those are the stations that people show. We don't want to brush this question, so that in future, when you plan, you take all these things into consideration. As far as I am concerned, as we are concerned as members, the people, I can't talk about other areas, because even if I ask you where it is located, I will not know. But I can talk about Western Cape because I know it very well. And in terms of the system A, really, you should expand your wings as much as possible, because your work to present the workers and listen to the complaints of the workers. I don't know how many workers managed to come to Cape Town. There are one or two. And we are not sure, you know, at times people must come. You might be, I know when people have eventually come, I must grant you, all those that have heard, they come, when they come, they are assisted. But the problem is coming. And that's what you should look at. I'm sure the pile of work that you have now, it will more than double if services were closer to people. And you must think about it, even if you do what other departments do, have on certain days a mobile unit that goes and stands somewhere like Home Affairs. Home Affairs, I know, every Friday it's in Langa, in the taxi rank. And all the people who want certificates and many other things that they get from Home Affairs, they know they can go to Langa Station. So we can also come up with such things in townships where you know that really our services are not closer to people. Then you do a plan, a second plan, to just bring services closer to people. Without, you don't have to justify your being defensive. It is that situation, something that we can own. And take down the employers. For those who have money. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
I don't know, Honorable Audience. I thought that you have grown. Yeah, it is you must lift up your hand. It was so quiet, and I appealed to you that please that status quo must remain. Yes, Honorable Olive.
Chairperson, I can attest to the fact that I have grown. A number of members and staff were complaining that I'm not as small as I used to be when I was last on this committee, but thank you, your point is noted.
Thank you for the assistance, Chair, and the present text that you suggested on board. I'm going to continue with the questions that were raised. The next question that we were addressing was in relation to job saving and the job saving unit that I mentioned. And the question was, who needs to initiate a job saving intervention or process in relation to that? And while often job saving initiatives come through trade unions, it is also common and often that employers will approach the CCMA to investigate or to assist them in facilitating a process for all the kinds of work that we have in relation to our job saving unit. And the law envisages not just a process triggered by a trade union or employee, it is also a process triggered by employers in that instance. My colleague, Commissioner
Sigurd,
wants to add something,
sir. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think what happens is a lot of these processes actually traditionally have come to the CCMA when actual retrenchments were contemplated. So the CCMA then started doing what it was supposed to do. But we're happy to report that over the years, what we used to do in those processes compared to what we do now is chalk and cheese. So once upon a time, a CCMA commissioner would merely sit and chair that process of employer and union battling over retrenchment. We now have a much more interventionist approach to that. My director has alluded to the involvement of sister organizations like Productivity South Africa, like the Industrial Development Corporation, and even DTI and EDD that are brought into these processes to help. Because sometimes, depending on what is the reason for the retrenchment, it may be one of those departments that can assist. For example, when we're dealing with the proposed retrenchments in, I can't remember the name of the company right now, but it was to do with in the dressed chicken industry, because we basically get competition with imported chicken. So it was the DGI that was able to come to our assistance there. If I may, Chair, can I take the next question? All right. The next question related to what is called the collective bargaining improvement process. There were two questions there. There was the collective bargaining improvement process is something that the CCMA has developed to basically address one of the key problems in collective bargaining, which is what we identified as a failure of parties to reflect and learn from subsequent bargaining rounds. So effectively what parties have been doing year after year is basically coming back and doing the same thing again and again and again, and we become blind to the fact of what we are actually doing. So the collective bargaining improvement process is a structured process in terms of which we basically analyze the wage negotiation. We look at four broad things. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? What helped us from reaching agreement? What hindered us from reaching agreement? In a very structured manner with the partners together. Now, we have piloted this process in the civil engineering sector, where we are working with SAFSEC, NUM and Bacau, and we've had several meetings with them, and we are now going towards the end of the process where we are working with them to implement actual initiatives that have been identified from that process. So in a nutshell, that's what the collective bargaining improvement process is. I'm hoping one day it's going to be a very popular common thing that we'll all use.
Thank you.
The second question related to the, you know, assisting bargaining councils, you know, with their dispute resolution. Yes, we have a statutory bodies liaison that basically works with bargaining councils, you know, in terms of the accreditation, and as well as we monitor and evaluate their dispute resolution. So that is the way the assistance is made to them. But I think it's not as easy as saying that, you know, if you assist, it's going to improve. There could be other dynamics at play. All right. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'm going to continue. Mr. Ronnie, do you want to add in? Okay. The next question was in relation to the training that we demonstrated and the work that we're doing with the partnerships of the universities. And the question was, how does that training work? Is it a replacement for commissioner training, or is it an augment for training, or how is it going to operate? We're in a handover phase in relation to that. The long-term vision is that this will be the commissioner training externally that you would do at a university, and you would also then get proper recognition for the work that you put into it, because CTMA cannot give us certificates in relation to that. But that doesn't prevent and wouldn't stop the CTMA, what would actually be required in any event, to do additional training for commissioners internally, and that they would have to do those courses as well or when they're employed as part of their ongoing continuous professional development program. So as it stands at the moment, if you're appointed as a commissioner, the CTMA will train you internally. However, we are in a handover phase where we're going to actively be working with the universities, where many of our commissioners are obviously going to do the training as well, and then you would be able to do the training at the university and get the qualifications for that, and you would then either be sent by the CTMA or you could do it on your own accord, and when you applied to the governing body to become a commissioner, you would have already done part of the training. It wouldn't mean that the CTMA's training obligation would go away to the individual commissioners, but it would assist in the fact that it would open it up to many more people to do it in advance of coming to apply to be a commissioner. The next question is in relation to the question that was raised was the CTMA's obligation in relation to promoting labour peace, and that we've made a statement in relation to some resolution. And then there was also a question, I think it's related, but I might have written it out separately, is in relation to the rate of review of arbitration awards. And so I'm going to ask Commissioner Ariani to deal with the issue in relation to arbitration awards, and I'm going to look up the statistics quickly in relation to the other questions.
Madam Chair, on the question of on the reviews, I think the question was asked about the rate of reviews that we have. Just to give an example, it's about 10% of our case logs when we're dealing with reviews, just to give a direct answer. And just to give a very practical example, for the period between the 1st of April 2014 to 31st of May 2014, we processed in our system about 221 reviews from the party. That's what we process through our system. But the department expanded on the question. It is not just about the question of numbers and the role that the system plays and the idea in terms of the amendments and what the system is doing. If Madam Chair, I need to expand on that, I will, but I just thought maybe in terms of statistics as requested, if that's the only question, that's the direct response that the Chair of us in order to be direct to the question. But if called upon to do so, we can expand on the process of review, how we process them, our relationship with the Labour Court, and how we have incorporated and the analysis we conducted on the typical problems that we have, and how we have synchronized our functions within the amendments on how it's going to play our part in ensuring that the solution is there, because there's different interpretations and factors to take into account. So I will be guided by you, Chairperson, if indeed we need to respond. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some chair's response of the question, I think I can reflect. That is partially linked to the question on the training provided. because the review has got a bearing, in fact the training has got a bearing on the level of review. So if in your response, rather than taking us in the very broad scope, just reflect it in as far as the capacity of the people involved in the whole process is concerned, if I'm not confusing you. Am I confusing you? I'm saying cases or awards are taken for review, while one of the things may be because those that were involved in the actual case lack capacity in one area or the other. Then for you to avoid your awards being taken for review every now and again, are there mechanisms in place?
I'm not taking instructions, just wanted to add something to this point. Chair, let me explain on the parties and so that we understand each other when we talk reviews and the factors that she's referring to and it linked to the trend. Number one, I will say it clearly as a clear professional position. It is practically impossible for any institution of dispute resolution, including the CCMA, that they can completely eliminate reviews. That's a factual position. Number two, the decision to review, it is not the decision of the CCMA, it is the parties. Number three, the decision to review is not based just on the performance of the commission. There are other factors. Let me give an example. Some of the parties, which is the most wrongful thing that is being done by certain parties, is when certain parties, when they lost reviews against the awards of especially the vulnerable employees, just to delay the case. That's one of the reasons. Number two, some review our awards because they want to create law. Some refer or review our cases not because they want to review the conduct of the proceedings by the commissioner. It is because they do not agree with the reasoning and the merits of the case, which is not becoming an appeal process. Because that is a problem relating for now to the act, not necessarily in terms of the system is functioning. But what systems then did we put in place? Number one, we have developed what we call an award quality index, which is constituted by teams, what we call panels of teams, which are located in all the regions of the CCMA. The sole function of those teams, number one, and the primary aspect of that, to avoid reviews based on poor quality of the awards, it is to ensure that all the CCMA awards that are issued within 14 days to the parties, that they meet the quality standards that we have set, which includes reasoning, which includes grammar, even the smallest of things like grammar, for example, and the analysis of the commission and the enforceability of the awards. So the teams that we select that peruse those awards must ensure that the content, form, and the execution and the legal status of that award is correct. That is the system that we place in place throughout all our regions. The National Office of the CCMA Responsibility is to oversee those processes and ensuring that when we receive those awards and we say we are issuing them to the parties, that we are satisfied that they are of good quality in terms of content, form, and execution. But what we cannot control as a decision is that when a party decides that because I do not want to implement the award, I am therefore going to review the award, we cannot stop that. Our obligation in terms of that process is just to deliver the record. To a certain extent, if there is a serious irregularity which involves the CCMA, in certain cases, we do get ourselves involved as a party to those proceedings and make all our relevant submissions to the Labour Court. What we are happy about, Madam Chair, is the content of the amendment as they appear now in relation to awards. Part of those amendments is ensuring that some of these cases that are being reviewed, they're just being reviewed and there's no further action taken. And the CCMA cannot, at least as far as the review process is concerned, be able to go to the Labour Court and say, but the one party has been reviewed for this period and the case has stagnated, what is happening? Because in terms of the way the papers are drafted in the review applications, we are not necessarily an active party to that. It is up to the parties in whose favor the award has been made and the one who's challenging that particular award. But to the extent that we have to play our role as the CCMA, for example, in delivering the records,
to the labor court to ensure that the parties the matter is completed expeditiously, because if there's lack of completion and there's also an offense to expedition to the resolution of the case, it does create social justice. That part we understand. It is for that reason, Madam Chair, that we have decided to take an action and say, how can we as the Commission help parties to ensure that the record of the proceedings they receive, for them to complete quickly, they receive a proper and a quality of a record. We have now entered in a process where we have procured a very good quality system, not only dealing with audio, but also with the video material, that ensures that the record that is before the court is complete. So to that extent, the system is contributing and ensuring that the matter is completed expeditiously. But internally, as far as our obligations are concerned, we are spot on and we are satisfied with. So the mechanisms are in place for quality, and our mechanisms in terms of complying with the rules of the court and playing our part to the extent we expected in law to deal with the review material. So as far as that is concerned, that is our plan. But over and above that, Madam Chair, it's not just about the question of the quality of the award, because that is the end product. Our interventions throughout the year and throughout all these processes of the arbitrations, conciliations, facilitations, is the element of training. We have every second month what we call a case law monitor. In that monitor, and you would find in our Gazette actually that deals with arbitration, which is about 28% of our total case loads, you will find that the primary responsibility of the Commission is to ensure that the Commissioner who appears before the parties is competent and he is able to deal with the most simple, like a domestic matter, and most complex matter where parties are represented by senior counsel. So what are we doing in that? We have created a clear obligation, not just in the question of discussion, but in the contractual obligation of every commission, that at every board, at least at a minimum of 10 sessions that we hold here, where we update statute, rules, practice notes, including the legal case law, that every commissioner who has the title of being a commissioner is ready to deliver the service. We train every second month to ensure that at least the commissioner is at that level. That training is over and above the entry training that qualifies to become a commissioner. And of course, at the end of the day, we have our own, what we call INDABA, wherein the complete review of the training we've done about the latest case law that is available to Congress is shared, so that our commissioners are always one step ahead in terms of knowing the current positions of law, so that when they make those awards, in terms of training, they are to stand so that we deliver a quality award. So in terms of our systems internally and the role that we play, we are on point. I can ask for if
any does the department want to say something on or follow up in addition to the response of gentleman from the CMA in terms of minimizing the number of reviewers? No.
And let me share with your permission on the essential services part.
That's
okay.
I'm still on this issue, because I don't think that the member was saying you were talking about minimizing, and it's good that you explained to us the role that you play when in this review come to you. I'm not going to ask any further question on this, but I'm not 100% sure that the answer cannot come from here, because you play your role and then the labor court, which is the labor court, play its role, and I'm not certain. However, I'm not going to pursue this question today. I see, noted your hands, Honorable Mkulisi,
Kululi. Let me give the men an opportunity. Maybe you want to assist us. But what I would want to ask from you as a follow-up question, the training that you are talking about, who does this training? But let's allow him to talk on this issue of minimizing the number of prisoners.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. I hope my colleague from the district not dealt with this. The amendments that was made in the law are trying to do exactly that. What was said in the law, the intention of the legislature in 1995, when new members of parliament passed the LRA, was to make the decision of the CCMA final and binding. But things have moved in the opposite direction, that most of the 16A decisions are not final and binding anymore because of reviews. We put a provision in the law that says any party that wants to review an award to the labor court, if the decision of the CCMA says I must be paid if the DG dismissed me unfairly, and the CCMA says I must be paid a year's salary, and the DG says, no, we cannot afford it, we want to review that decision, then the proposal made in the law is to say, then the department must put security. And that security is the amount that the CCMA said, I must be paid. Remember, companies are reviewing in order to run away from the obligation. Then we say, okay, you want to review? Put the same amount that he would have given me as security in the court. That's the first thing that he did. The second thing was that if the decision of the CCMA is that I must be reinstated at work, and the company wants to review that, then the company must put security equal to 24 months of my salary. We believe those things are going to reduce drastically, because reviews are about running away from obligation. Now, when the company is going to put 24 months salary as security instead of reinstating me, it's going to think twice. And those are the processes that we put in law to assist with the process of minimizing review, because as the members are indicating, the decisions of the CCMA must be final and binding. It should be only exceptional cases that are taken on review. It cannot be a matter of course. And we're hoping, as soon as the president runs, that process is going to assist us to minimize the reviews. Thank you very much.
I've noted your honorable audit, but let's allow the gentleman to finish. Are you done? Are you okay? Covered. Question of training, the process of training, getting the training, paying out for the trainer.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the biggest portion of training providers for the CCMA is the CCMA itself. Because we believe that what the university can provide, it can give formal training, it can educate people at the theoretical level. We accept that. But the best part to train our commissioners is to get your senior commissioners who are well seasoned to conduct the training. So our commissioners, our seasoned commissioners, senior commissioners, conduct those trainings for commissioners. So we are satisfied that it's not just about teaching the Labor Relations Act, the Employment Equity Act, and all the employment law. It is about clothing the theoretical understanding with the practical experience, and especially experiences done through processes by a person who is in the process, who has been in the process. He can share those practical experiences, because theory is not enough. We have accepted that. That's why it has become a permanent feature for every month, every year. So, answering your question directly, Madam Chair, we conduct our own training. Let me add that we are not that selfish about ourselves, using that word loosely, in a way that we do employ additional expertise when necessary, for example. If, for example, there's a particular provision, to give an example, the regulations relating to the amendments now on the employment equity. We know, for example, that Professor Paul Benjamin is good in the field. We would then invite him, if not invite him, for to seek opinions on how do we settle this particular provision for purpose of our commissioner. And what we appreciate from that, whatever opinion is given, it does not go as raw as it is. It goes through our filtering process to ensure that what we give our commissioner is exactly correct. So we do take ownership of our training, and we do training ourselves. And that's what we've done in relation to our amendments coming as our director provided. That in the current amendment, you have Section 198 that deals with the labor broadcast, for example, or what we call non-standard employment. You've got the organizational rights amendment, which is Section 21. Then you've got the employment equity, interest arbitration, and essential services committee. What we've done is to establish all those specialist groups for them to be able to prepare our commissioners to be ready when the amendments come. Because then one of the biggest positives you find in training is when we concentrate on the amendment but divorce the current and applicable provision, we've managed to match the two parties. Every one of those special groups that trained all our commissioners, it has been our most senior commissioners who drafted the material. It's been the same drafters of that material who presented those cases. As I understand, Madam Chair, we can, with certainty and without any doubt, say to you, the CCMA is ready to deal with those specific matters because we've taken it upon ourselves as a commission to make sure that our commissions are ready to deal with that. In addition to that, is the minimization question, on what Mr. McCarthy was talking about, there's an important addition that has been made that deals with prescription. One of the most misconduct issues you will find is when a party delays the enforcement of an award until 3 years where a matter prescribes. Now, in terms of the amendment, if somebody applies for a review, we continue with the enforcement, which is what we call part of Section 143, the enforcement of the awards. What has then happened? One of the most serious injustices that we've experienced in the which we're trying to protect on the part of the employees, is when a successful party goes to the employer and says, here's an award that says pay me 100,000 rand, and reinstate it. And they say no, because we have reviewed. The amendments have dealt with that. Until such time that you pay exactly the cost or the security that we're talking about, where an amount is placed in trust, that this is the total amount that would have been due to the employee. If you want to review, then do that. If you don't do that, be enforced. That's the part we support. The Department of Labor also must be louded, Madam Chair, that we are trying to create a fund where it because one of the practical problems that we have, it deals with the questions of the sheriffs. One of the employees would go there and say, will you please go and attach the assets of this employer because he has failed to pay me what is due in terms of the award. The question of valid advice says no. So after the sheriff, to be able to do what you have just said, you must pay at least a deposit of 10,000. If you look at the award, he's been awarded exactly the same amount. Where would a vulnerable employee get that amount to be able to execute that type of an award? Now we've made an intervention wherein we will be able to say, okay, yes, the security for cause is not yours, then let's proceed with the process of execution. Then the vulnerable is dealt with. We are satisfied with that. Because that's what justice and social justice is about. And that's the role that we're playing as the Commission. So we are satisfied with the Chair in terms of the minimization issue. The issue of the elimination of the prescription provisions that we found, especially as it appears in the amendments at the moment, is helping us a great deal. Because now we know that our awards that we issue are not fruitless. They are binding in law, and we can enforce them. So all of those discussions, and I can confirm to you, Madam Chair, that last week already we've had a meeting with the chief of the sheriff's board, wherein they have brought him into what we've just discussed now to ensure that justice is served, especially in the execution of the awards. So you can rest assured that we are on the ball when it comes to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your elaborated response. And
At least I'm happy to hear that, and I hope it will not change somewhere, somehow, that the commissioners of the CCMA, they are excised or they are used as the trainers. CCMA does not outsource that responsibility, neither does it use consultancy. It does it on its own. That's what I appreciate.
Thank you, Chair. That is correct. The next question was the detailed employment equity breakdown. There is a little bit more detail in the annual report, but I'd like to ask with permission if I can send the whole detailed breakdown, because I think, as I understand the honourable member's question, it was right down all the way, the whole report, and we do have it, but I don't have it here. So I would ask to send it to the Chair. The employment equity, the request was for a more detailed breakdown than I gave. And there's some of it in the annual report, but it doesn't go, I think, to the whole detail of the question was. If you have it, I just don't have it yet.
So can we finish on Thursday?
Yes.
Can we get it by Monday?
Certainly, Chair. I will try and see if somebody can get it now, but Monday later.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question was around the beneficiary of subsidy, but I think we've covered that with the CFO in relation to that. Then following on that, we had the question about the labour stability and peace and performance issues. I'm going to ask Commissioner Subedar to assist in relation to answering that.
Thank you, Chair. In answering this question, there were like three questions asked, two questions asked. Well, number one, what is our performance in terms of labour peace? And, you know, how does the CCMA get involved? The members said the CCMA seems to come in at the end and then something happens. Okay, I'm going to start from behind. Firstly, when it comes to matters that have gone beyond the CCMA, so you would have, and I'll use maybe the platinum strike as an example. The platinum strike would have come in when those wage negotiations deadlocked. In fact, we had three separate disputes that came to the CCMA. We tried very hard to conciliate those disputes, but we could not conciliate them, and we issued certificates saying that the disputes were unresolved, and then the strike basically started. Okay. Alright, and then there was an intervention. Now, the only time the CCMA can intervene in a matter that has gone to that extent is when both parties consent. And that is one of the things that we are trying to address in terms of the new amendments that we look forward to. But effectively what happens is, if both parties don't consent, the CCMA can't intervene. And the timing of this consent is, the timing of our intervention is very important, because if we try to intervene on the very first day of the strike, it is the union that basically says, no, you know, we're not prepared to agree to your intervention here. And because, you know, everybody's fresh and the picket line is all very exciting on the first day of the strike. And if one intervenes too late, it is the employer that basically says, well, the strike is not having any effect, so we don't need to intervene. So we basically look at the timing of that intervention very, very closely. And we monitor what is called, this is what I'm telling you is in terms of Section 150 of the Labor Relations Act. And we monitor how many times both parties actually accept our offer of assistance when we make it. And if I can refer to the last annual report, that figure for the what we call the Section 150 acceptance rate was basically sitting at 95%. So in 95% of the cases where the CCMA offered to intervene, the parties accepted our intervention. Now, in terms of our performance, the reality of the situation is that when you are dealing with these disputes, what we call public interest disputes, there are sometimes other factors at play, you know, like we've seen in the platinum sector strike as well. And they are not as easy to resolve as normal wage disputes. So normal wage disputes, we normally resolve, you know, between 60 to 62% of them upfront when we talk about all wage disputes that first come into the CCMA. When it comes to these disputes last year, it was particularly a hard year, especially in the mining sector, and we had a resolution of in the region of about 56% of those disputes. So just over half of those disputes that came that we basically intervened in, we actually resolved. Okay. This year, that figure has improved tremendously. In fact, when we come back again to present the current year's figures, that, you know, that figure is sitting up in the 90s right now. But I think what we need to see is, like, you know, I think each time the CCMA's performance on these type of disputes comes into the conversation, what dominates the conversation is the platinum strike, and somewhat unfairly, because, you know, it played out in a different way. You know, if I look at some of the other disputes that the CCMA has resolved over the years, for example, one of the CCMA's, you know, greatest contributions to industrial peace in this country has been in the private security sector. I think there's nobody who will forget the 2006 private security strike, when some 74 people lost their lives, and there was massive you know, destruction to property and that type of thing. Do you know we've not had a strike since 2006 in the private security sector? And that was only because, Chair, the CCMA worked with the parties since 2006, okay, establishing what is called the National Bargaining Forum, because the parties are not representative enough to form a bargaining council. And in that structure, we basically negotiated the last two times, so in 2009 and 2011. And that initiative of the CCMA effectively gave us 6 years of labor peace in that sector. You know? Now, what happens is, like, if you only think of the platinum sector, you forget about those things, you know. In 2009, the civil engineering strike that basically threatened our World Cup plans and almost made South Africa, FIFA, go to Plan B, it was the CCMA that resolved that matter and basically got our stadiums back on track, and we had our World Cup. You know, I can look up, I think of lots of examples like that. So, in terms of our performance, the direct answer to the question is, the performance last year was poor on these public interest matters. It was 56% because of various challenges. It has improved tremendously since last year, sitting in the upper 90s as we speak, and we hope that it will maintain itself at that level. But we doing the best that we can under the circumstances, all other things being equal.
Thank you, Chair. The next question relates to officers, but I think we've covered that clearly. And then the next question, and it partly touches also on the question asked by Honourable Touch. Honourable Madisha. And that was in relation to the inter-union rivalry that we put up on the last slide, and the challenges in relation to that, and how is the CCMA dealing with the challenge between the labour demands and the community demands that are, we use the word coalescing, but that are uniting in the demands that come to the workplace. And then there was also a question in relation to, could we predict what was happening, and did we know what was happening in relation to what's happened? I'm going to answer that partly with Asil, and then I'm going to hand over to you.
Thank you. I can't remember what Honorable Matisha was saying. When you refer to community and the workers, is there a specific area that you made as an example?
No, sorry, Chair. He was asking about inter-union rivalry. What is the CCMA doing? Okay, so the question was posed around how we're dealing with inter-union rivalry, and then in relation to the labour market and community. So perhaps we'll answer the issue in relation to inter-union rivalry and then move on to the question in relation to the labour market and community demand. And so divide them out. And perhaps we'll answer the question at the end. Okay. Thanks.
council can be built and seen rather than Christian.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The inter-union rivalry is a huge problem for us, and you know, it has basically escalated from a minor problem, you know, some months ago to the huge problem that we have now. Now, in terms of the law, you know, really the only thing available to us is to basically be able to conduct verification exercises to confirm, you know, which union, you know, people want to belong to. But the problem is that sometimes you can't rely on the law for these things. And I'll use the example of a particular platinum company that was approached by a particular union, and we tried to basically say, okay, fine, let's do a verification exercise, because there was suspicion that, you know, the one union had intimidated members of the other union to resign and join its union, etc. And so we basically went there and tried to basically set up a process in terms of which we were going to verify employee by employee, you know, which union a person wanted to belong to. And that process never happened because we were not allowed to have that process. I mean, we basically went up, and at the first site that we put up a tent, because we can't do this in the open, one has to do it in some degree of privacy, and I think most of us know how a mine shaft area looks. There's a hole in the ground, but there's buildings around it, and it's like in a compound setup. And we had put this tent up in the middle of all of that, and in the tent we're going to sit the commissioners with interpreters talking to one person at a time, completing a ballot. And within probably 40 minutes of us putting the tent up, it was destroyed, because people did not want this process to go ahead. And then out of concern for the security of our commissioners, we actually pulled out of that process. Okay. Now, there's very little that we have at our disposal to deal with the question of inter-union rivalry. And strictly speaking, you know, it becomes more of a turf war between two organizations. And it brings a different dynamic to the normal employer-trade union relationship. Now, we designed to sit and work with an employer and a trade union that has been recognized through the, you know, through the Labor Relations Act and that type of thing. But what we can't, as the CCMA, do is we can't get into organizing for organized labor. You know, labor has to do its own organizing. But if you recall that last slide that was put up, one of the things that we're looking at doing in terms of our broad mandate is realizing that this is going to become a bigger and bigger and bigger problem. 2 years ago, the platinum companies thought that AMCU was a flash in the pan that was going to go away in 6 months. That is why some of the companies took forever in trying to recognize AMCU, and we had the kind of violence and everything that we saw. Today, suddenly, we are in a different reality altogether. Okay? Going forward, I mean, there's other unions that are going to emerge, and, you know, AMCU itself might, you know, decide that it wants to go into other sectors and that type of thing, and this is going to cause problems. The way the law is set up as well, that, you know, we're trying to give more representation to, you know, to unions and that type of thing. So what the CCMA is going to be working on, and this is at this stage in time a thought in our minds, to basically develop some kind of structured confidence building measures between unions that have to work together in the workplace. Okay, it is something that's on the drawing board. It's not something that we have right now, but that's a plan for the future. Confidence building measures, you know, designed to basically assist unions to exist together in workplaces, because we know that labor peace is not only about the interaction between an employer and a trade union, but also between trade unions and trade unions. And employers can't afford to just ignore a trade union rivalry. It has problems too. In terms of, like, you know, the increase in unprotected strikes, fortunately, that trend seems to be changing. But I think the problem that we have here is that there is this I won't say disregard for the law, but a loss of confidence in the law. We saw this very clearly in Marikana, and we saw it very clearly in the 2009 stadium strikes. Every time there was a grievance, you know, instead of going through the process of, you know, telling the union, etc., etc., workers in Bombela Stadium, for example, so it could just to down tools and basically say, we want this. And every strike, in fact, there were 19 work stoppages in our World Cup stadiums. Two of those were protected, 17 were unprotected. So between a disregard for the rule of law and a loss of confidence in the instruments of law is what's giving us this tendency of increased unprotected industrial action. I mean, as we speak, we've got senior commissioners dealing with unprotected industrial action in Transnistria, as we speak. They started with that process yesterday and they're continuing today. So that talks to the unprotected destruction. Thank you, Chair.
And Chair, I think it's important to note the CCMA gets itself into a difficult situation because it should facilitate in protected strikes, but we do go out and help in unprotected strikes because we see them part of the role of stability in the labour market. Because we'd be encouraging workers to listen to what their issues are, to go back to work and follow the process correctly, so the rule of law in relation to how you strike is maintained in relation to that. But it can become a challenge for the Commission. The following question related to the CCMA analysing trends and predicting what's been going on in the labour market and what does the CCMA do about that. Obviously, starting with the hindsight, always an easy thing to evaluate on. But given what's happened recently in the Northwest sector, I'm moving into talking about our dispute prevention and management section. The CCMA, prior to 2012 and 2013, had given papers and talks in relation to what was happening in the platinum sector and in the mining sector, specifically in Northwest, and I've even given papers and I've also given papers in relation to the concerns that we had in relation to the disputes that were arising, the unprotected strikes, the inter-union rivalry that was developing. The CCMA in its discretionary function may identify these issues, may talk to the parties, may talk to trade unions, may talk to the employers, but other than that, if they don't take on board what we're saying and don't agree with us, or their other advisors agree, we actually disempower to do anything more than say, we, you know, this is what we think. And they may not agree with us, we could be wrong, but in this situation we did predict significantly that there was going to be a rise of challenges in the area, and we didn't receive much response in relation to that, and that's really the answer to that. So in some areas we are able to predict from our trends, from our analysis. In other areas it's not that easy for us to predict, but we do try and make sure we have our ears on the ground and are accessible in relation to what's happening with that. And that's an important area of the work that we do. Do you want to add on that?
Chair, also what we do is we develop a tool that we basically use in all our regions to monitor labor market developments based on, you know, a prediction of the level of conflict. So it's really a chart with three colors, yellow, orange, and red, and we basically look at different conflict levels. So if you came to my office, you would see on my chart under the red that there is the, well, until before the platinum strike was sorted out, the platinum strike was there, but under the orange, it is wage negotiations that are taking place at present that are maybe close to deadlocking, and in the yellow section, wage negotiations that are just starting. We also tell our regions to actually monitor any type of situation. That's a little known fact that, I mean, you know, most of us have been watching the World Cup and watching all the industrial action that, that Brazil has had. And we can hold our heads up proud that we didn't have that type of situation in South Africa. We had one unprotected strike during the World Cup, which was by those security guards, but not the kind of mayhem that we've seen in Brazil. And that was because of what the CCMA did. Late in 2007, early 2008, we embarked on a process with the parties to basically develop a peace accord, etc. But more important than that, what we did after that was we basically looked from all the host cities where we had offices, and we looked at the host cities and we developed what is called a conflict threat matrix. So we basically looked at any kind of service or goods that were going to be associated with the World Cup. We got involved with, you know, who are the parties involved, the employers and trade unions, made contact with them and kept monitoring them. So it's a little known fact that, you know, 2 weeks before the FIFA family moved into that apartment block in Santon, what's it called, the Michelangelo, that there was a threat of a strike there. But we got to know it because of this monitoring and basically went in and resolved the strike, you know, before they came in. So, yes, we have this very structured approach to monitoring the labor market.
Thank you, Chair. Moving on to the next set of questions, they're partly related to employment equity, so I think in the finishing report they would address those concerns. There was an issue around the female employees of CTMA and disability. I need to put up a slide again because I think it doesn't address, it's an issue reflected in percentages and not in numbers, and I think that's why the question was asked, but we give a formal indication to you exactly what explaining all the issues are, because in fact CTMA employs more females than employees now. The next question related to staff benefits. Do they benefit from the university cooperation process? And that certainly is the case. At the moment, the CTMA actually funds the staff to go on the training internally, but when it goes externally, we would fund staff in relation to that. And as indicated previously by my colleague, while we're partnering with the university on certain academic areas, many of the commissioners are actually working with the university to do the training. So, could we actually believe that we hold the source of that training in the sense that the people have got the best skills in the organization, not external people? And that's why we do that. The next question relates to the Essential Services Committee and the Minimum Service Agreement and the status of them. Now, I know we've answered it a lot, but I think that Ms. Mariani would still like to give further information on that, so I'm going to hand to him in relation to that, which is just elaborating on how do we get minimum services agreed. Okay.
Madam Chair, I just want to give a 3 points on the key question which was asked, what is the process that is followed in dealing with essential services function. Let's just say, as a matter of law, there is no institution or a court in this country that can declare or determine that a particular service is essential. They can't be. They're legally incompetent. That function is the function of the CCM, in particular, the Essential Services Committee. That's number one. Number two, whatever views that any industrial sector may have, whether they are essential or not, it is insufficient for any institution for it to be declared or a determination to be made for them to be essential. They have to bring that application to the ESC. Then the ESC will make a determination. Once the determination is made, then it gets publicized in the form of a gazette. That's the process that before, and that is the simple step. I can confirm to you, Chair, that the Essential Service Committee, following my meeting with the chairperson, in the current financial year, we've made sufficient budget that will cover a substantial portion of the institutions that require the intervention of the creation of the minimum service level agreements. It's on the project plan, it's budgeted. So that part will be dealt with. I just thought that those points are important that we covered to put the committee at ease, that the intervention in ensuring that the minimum service level agreements are done, that we have taken action on that, and we're actioning the current financial year. If need be, Chair, in the next one when we come, and also in relation to the ESCOM matter, we can give particulars in relation to that, but one of the problems that we find in the EFC is when parties disagree on the question of jurisdiction, whether it should go to private arbitration or not. But the bottom line is that that functional determination rests with the EFC. What I want to undertake to you, Chair, if you can put the committee at ease, is that in the next one when you come, we will give you full details on each and every institution where we have the minimum service level agreement concluded and those that are pending, and give you specifically which institutions are those. I think it will assist the committee as well with that information. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Moving on, the next two questions I'm going to answer together because they're partly related to the same department. in the presentation we put up the issue in relation to discretionary functions and mandatory functions. A lot of the work that we do in relation to education, training, is a discretionary function, which I think is very, very important. And the question that came was, there was no information in the presentation correctly around the kind of work that we're doing in educating employers and workers and in relation to publicity. In the course of the year that we are closing reporting on now, 1,862 events were taking place in relation to either user and sector forum training and meetings, various summits. We did roadshows in relation to that. We had visa meetings in relation to sectors. We had workshops, which is best practice workshops, with parties, both employers and trade unions and employees on how to use the CCMA, short sessions on presenting labor law amendments or any other topic of interest, as well as that's related to that. But in addition to that, this year we have had a partnership with the SADC where we delivered on, from November to February, a very specific program where we were actually on all community radio stations and an educative process on those community radio stations over a period of several months, educating people in South Africa about the work that the CCMA does on various topics. That's not a once-off event. The Dispute Management and Prevention Department has various slots on all community radio stations at least once a month, if not every week, where commissioners will go and give information in relation to the CCMA, in relation to the work it does, and in relation to questions that they're thrown in from the workplace in relation to that. So we do have quite a lot of work that we do in relation to promoting the service of the CCMA as goes forward. Moving on then, the questions I want to touch on, some of them have been answered as we've reached along, which relates to the four projects and the funding and the timelines in relation to that. And then the Essential Services Committee question, I think that's been covered. If you feel any more questions, please indicate, but I think we've covered the order. And then the issue on the strike as well and the platform sector has been addressed. Then Chairs, I'm taking it that the last question was a question from Honourable Madisha, which I think Honourable was asking about also about inter-union and inter-union rivalry, which I think we've addressed now. And so basically I think that we've answered that question, but we are obviously open to hearing from members. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much. Do we have further questions for the clarification? Only one hand. Honourable Natasha.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think the entity has sort of covered.
I think the entity has responded to our previous question. But I thought we still have to look into the express claim, which we have not, talked on the last round of questions. With your permission, Chair. Thank you. On the APP chain, they made annual operational targets and set specific figures on the number of postponements or agendas over the 5-year period. Given that postponements and cancellations can be claimed, why have you guys made this target? Again, the NDC has set targets to assist, support, promote, and enhance the quality of collective bargaining to high impact offers of assistance made in public interest matters. It has set a target of 52% of public interest matters resolved. What is the current settlement rate of public interest matters? Again, on the same matter, the APP, The APP refers to the promotion of employment security through publicity and capacity building activities. Can they expand on this? This target is very broad. And CCMA needs to be very specific on the kind of initiative that will be taken. It's tabulated on a document on page 15. Lastly, Chair, what are the functions of the newly established job saving unit? How does each work link with some activities performed by the productivities of the expenditure?
Thank you, Honorable Mayor.
Over to the CCMA.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start and hand over to Ms. Moriarty in relation to settling of postponements and adjournments. One of the challenges that we have is people seek postponements and adjournments to try and delay the matter for the, particularly in relation to employers or if there's legal representation. And then you also have the human factor where commissioners might also disagree to because they feel like going home that day. So we put it in as a measure to try and ensure that we can manage the process more effectively and ensure that we deliver on what's in the Labour Relations Act of speedy dispute resolution. Mr. Rowley, going to give elaboration on that.
Madam Chair, in our analysis lately, when it comes to the question dealing with postponements, one of the major problems we found, which we are trying to deal with in our rules, the Chair would have noted that in the presentation by the Director, that one of the things that we've done as a result of the amendments is to amend our own rules, and we completed that function, but now we're reviewing the portion that deals particularly with issues relating to postponements. The biggest problem that we found, other than the normal stuff where the parties are not ready to proceed, it is the intervention of attendants. I know I'm an attendant of the profession, but I'm going to say the same. When parties come before the commission and an attendant said, we are not ready to proceed, and our notice of our witnesses are not here, it becomes very difficult for the commission to proceed with the matter under those circumstances. What we don't have, which we are trying to look at now, what form of intervention can we make in our rules to ensure that we limit the number of postponements, especially as a result of the parties themselves, especially with the intervention of the attendee? What is even worse than letting check is that when an attendee comes and says, I'm not ready to proceed, and then we say, can we proceed with another next week or in 2 weeks' time? Says, no, my dad is full, I'm ready in the next 3 months. That is the problem. And we have that gap in it in our rules as well, which I can concede right from the beginning. It was never our intention. And if we read the LLA in particular, one of its fundamental principles is that we must deal with arbitrations with minimum legal formalities. That includes also legal representations in the sense that when we get into process, what must not get to be over technical. But the CCMA commissioner, as an institution of statutory creation, to the extent that we've tried to deal with it in our Rule 25 on legal representations, we are unable to clamp down on the continuous postponement by parties themselves. Not the commissioners. In minimum cases, the commissioners, but it is the parties themselves. So the difficulty that we find as commissioners is when, even in the cases where there's no representation, when parties or one of the parties come and say, we are not ready to proceed. In those circumstances, Chair, we don't have power. But in cases where there's an application for postponement by one of the parties, then we do have power to exercise that discretion. But at the same time, in order again to minimize reviews, where we refuse postponements who are taken on review, on the ruling that the commissioners made. And the difficulty that we find there, Chair, is that when our commissioners' interlocutory rulings that are made are challenged at the Labour Court, and that's why the amendments currently have actually expressly stated that the parties cannot deal with matters such as arbitration in piecemeal, in the sense that if there's a ruling on legal representation that is made, you cannot go to the Labour Court and challenge it and suspend the proceedings and wait for the court to set it down in the next 2 years. So there's an intervention in terms of the amendments. So, in short, the design we are making in our rules in contemplation of what the LRA has now provided in the amendment, we think we'll be able to contain the postponement question. But what we are struggling with, and the only thing we're struggling with, is how can we, legally speaking, be able to stop parties from continuing to postpone matters indefinitely? That's the biggest challenge that we have. But that's the debate we're having before we finalize our rules. And I believe, Chair, we will find a solution by the time the rules are actually presented.
Thank you. From your response, the picture that you are painting is that the reason for this postponement are more from the other side, not from you. Where is the statistics?
Madam Chair, we do not collate the statistics of that nature. We have statistics of cases postponed, but if it is the chair's request that we should, because most of these rulings, if not all of them, they are in the actual rulings, in the actual cases themselves. But we do not have a specific rate or specific statistics that we can present to this committee and say, in 2012-2013, in the context of postponements, 50% is as a result of parties. Commissioners, Madam Chair, are specifically instructed, and it is a clear efficiency that they must meet. No postponement unless on those exceptional grounds a postponement is granted. But it cannot, it should not. It should not be as an initiative of the Commission. That we don't do, but we don't have such specificity. I want to be honest about it, because Chair, you stated earlier on that in cases where we have those kinds of challenges, we must be honest with the committee. And I'm being honest with the committee, we do not keep statistics of postponement caused by the party. But if it is a suggestion of the chair that is the area we must look at, most certainly, but all the requests, because if I may just elaborate a little bit, when a commissioner has to...
Sorry, not really a little bit, but I think we are all on the same level as what you're saying, because you are saying it's the party, and you maintain that it's the party. Okay. Now, the problem that I think we will have is that you don't keep this statistic, but you are here 100%. We must be convinced that it's only the parties. That's where the problem is. That's where the problem is. I listened to your director when she spoke on this question, not in detail. She talked about the parties, and she talked about the commissioners at times, you know, that want to go home, something to that extent, you know. So, I really, listening to you, it's only you are just being defensive, and I have a problem. I will say it's defensive because there is no proof that you have that will convince this committee that indeed the delay are caused by the other parties, the parties that have no rep in this meeting, parties that cannot speak for themselves.
Yeah.
You see, so I is there a point of order?
No, not really. I want to make a statement with regard to the matter that...
Can you allow me to finish?
Absolutely.
Okay, switch off your mic. Yeah. So I think in future, if you don't keep those statistics, we can't just remember that you are one party, you are dealing with many parties. For us to understand and to be 100% sure that we are dealing with facts here, not assumptions. And in this particular case, you can have the statistics. You can keep it. So that when you talk, we don't have to ask questions that will not be really answered to the satisfaction. So I think that's what I want to advise. Honorable America.
Thank
you.
You want to say? Well, I want to say it's giving us a little bit.
Okay, yes. Thanks, Janet. Honorable America?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think I take note of the concerns expressed by you, but I need to come to the defense of the CCMA, because in my own experience, I was a former commissioner myself. The statistics that you would like to have, I could confidently say zero, because there's no need to maintain that kind of statistics. And I know, as a former commissioner, how difficult it was to postpone matters. You know, you just couldn't, as a commissioner, you just couldn't postpone matters. It must be exceptional circumstances. So I am of the view that you know, to support the assertion made by the CCMA in terms of the postponement, I don't think that we need to have statistical proof of that, because there's no need to have those statistics, because the practice of the CCMA, as far as my knowledge is concerned, my experience is concerned, is that by and large, under extreme exceptional circumstances, the postponements come from the commission and most are almost entirely from the parties involved. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable America, on behalf of the CCMA. Honorable Lollywood.
Can we not be confused? We have invited CCMA here. It will be so unfair if all of us go back to our previous deployment, because this is going to reduce this committee into something we don't understand. Even if we have previous experiences on a matter, let us give CCMA an opportunity to respond, because they do have the expertise. In my other life, I was a teacher. I can't go to the Portfolio Committee on Education and say, in my experience as a teacher, I must understand. Those who are never teachers may not understand what I understand with my experience as a teacher.
Thank you, Honorable
Mantha.
I rise to you know, concur with Comrade Loli, that we cautioned not to go back to where we come from. We come from different backgrounds, and this will destroy the integrity of this committee. Can we stick to what we are today as parliamentarians? Thank you.
Thank you very much, members, for the concerns that you are raising. The last time I remember, we were all members of Parliament. We are here to do an oversight over the department. And as members of Parliament, we have a right to ask questions. And as we are doing oversight, we don't do oversight on assumptions. We do oversight on the facts. That is why when they speak here, we listen to them. And tomorrow, we will go and see for ourselves whether what we have been told is true, or is it taking place, or it's neither here nor there. That is our responsibility. So I will appeal again, like my colleague, that let us all be members of Parliament. Because most people who are here, really, some of them, they don't want to tell you where, they won't tell you where they come from. But I think, and I'm not thinking, I'm searching, that they dealt with these issues, not through
the newspapers or through the book, but they have dealt with these issues physically. They know exactly when they ask the question. Some of them know why they're asking those questions. So I think let's keep our integrity and become members of Parliament and do what is expected of us to do, what is enshrined in our constitution as members of Parliament. Members of the officials of the department, any more questions to answer so that I can see the lunch is ready?
Just Michelle, there were two more questions.
What does the hand where who goes there? There, who must that? There's a hand at the back.
Honourable Chair, I just want to deal with the issue that was not addressed based on the suggestions or the proposal that deals with postponement or agenda. In the slides presented earlier, we do have a slide that talks about operating efficiency. Except to say the slide then gives you a data in terms of number of cases, percentage of postponement or agenda. But what we're missing in the slide is the detailed data in terms of cases that are postponed by parties. And we've taken note of the issues that you've raised, that in the near future, would this kind of expand on postponement based on non-parties? But we do have a slide that gives you a percentage, and there's a reduction in terms of the numbers over the period of 5 years. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the fact that you understand the question. More questions to be answered there, Ms. Khan?
Yes, Jinder, two more questions, one for two questions there. So the next question I'm going to ask, Mr. Stupid, I'll answer, and then I'll address the next one.
Thank you, Chair. This question related to the settlement rate on public interest matters is a target of I think it's 64% that's been set. The question that was asked is, what is the present rate? The present rate, I actually just looked it up right now on, we start our financial year from April. So for the period April, May and June, we've dealt with 51 of these public interest matters and settled 48 of them, which means that our settlement rate is 94%. In terms of our annual report that you have as of last year, the settlement rate was 56%, as I alluded to earlier. So it's quite high right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Apologies. there's another thing that we started tracking in this new financial year from April, which is the actual strike interventions that the CCMA is involved in. And I'm happy to report that we've had an 83% success rate on strike interventions between April and May. I don't have the figure for June yet, but for the 2 months it's been an 83% success rate. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Then the final question related to the employment services, and the first question was relating to that promoting employment security, that the target was very broad, and while I agree in that context, it is summarised that there are activities planned with milestones that you have to do in the operating plan that leave underneath it, but perhaps we should take that on board and try and put it at a higher level and give the details of the actual target in relation to that. I think that's a very valid point. Thank you, Chair. And then the question was, what does the unit actually do? And the unit is set up to try and have a more holistic and integrated approach to dealing with business distress and job security. So job security in relation to workers and business distress in relation to employers. We've sort of talked about it around and around in different ways. We haven't articulated it carefully.
and that is that they work with business recovery and job saving. So for businesses in distress, like we indicated, we might link with Productivity South Africa, DTI, or economic development to see what areas we can work at to try and see if we can support and assist or find an integrated way of saving the business so that the jobs can be saved. Likewise, with workers, we would listen to them because often workers get very good input on what should happen in the business, what the issues are they've actually skilled, and we've talked to them about what do they need, what are the training needs, what would they think should happen, how could we maybe restructure the work in a daily basis. So we've got people trained in relation to that, and there would also be work that we do as Productivity South Africa in relation to the in relation to that. This is all done under the auspices of Section 189 and 189A and the retrenchment processes. And then also the training level scheme would be considered as one of the options in relation to that. And that it's so that the process is kept as a consolidated unit and at work in relation to job losses, which are unintentional job losses, which is what we would refer them to because they don't relate to a dismissal. You lose an individual being retrenched. Fall under that category, and we actually isolate them and address them because we've had such a rise in cases of that nature over the last few years and continue to rise. Thank you, Chair. I trust that I've elaborated. Chair, that deals with the questions that I've been asked so far. Thank you very much.
Any more? Okay. Just one or two questions. They will be very short, I don't really need details. Nathan, you talked about the 75% rate of national settlement. Can you talk on this 75%? 75% of what number? And the companies that you conducted or you did settlement on them, in terms of category, where do they feature? You've got different categories of industries, companies. You have your BE companies, you have can you just say something on that? You also spoke about assisting industry during the time of hardship, both workers and employees. How do you get to know about them, and how many have you assisted, and which companies? Because I'm sure you won't have hundreds of them, let's say in the last two financial years. If you have any, I'm sure you can think of company A, company B, company C.
Thank you very much for the question. Thank you very much for the question, Chair. The 75% settlement rate that I referred to, which was on the operating efficiency slide, relates to all cases that are done in the CTMA and that are settled through conciliation. So I think I indicated to you that in the course of last year we had 170,000 and a bit more cases. So we're saying that, but in relation to the ones where we divided into dismissal cases, 75% of those and the collective bargaining type cases, which is wage disputes and that, 75% of those were settled. So I could probably get statistics for you and I've got no problem on sectors. I don't think we could get the details on the actual companies. We could get company names, but not the and if they are PTY limited, we couldn't get them who owns them. But I think we could probably have information. I'd have to look in our research department and see what we could get, but we can definitely give you that information to a certain degree. I don't know if we can give all of it. But I can give you the sectors and I can give you the breakdown, but I certainly I can't say that out of my head right now in relation to that. But I did put the sectors up as the most preferred, but we would be able to run statistics, and I'll offer to do that for you if you'd be interested.
In fact, that what I've written here is not part of what I said, it's part of what I wanted to ask. I just wanted to know as well those statements in that 75, how much percentage was in favor of workers and how much was in favor of the employers. So,
okay, so I can give you the statistics in relation to arbitration awards outcomes and settlement in favor of both. Okay. Okay. So in relation to arbitration award outcomes, it does vary by province quite interestingly, but nationally at the moment it is 60-40. So it's 60 in favor of employees and 40 in favor of employers. That's a national level. And I will elaborate.
Chair, in settlements, although I don't have the stats before me, have a fairly good idea of this, and I don't want to fall into the assumption trap with you again. But we track the settlement outcomes, and we basically find that in the region of about 86% of those settlement outcomes, where parties have entered into a settlement agreement, result in compensation. Okay? Sorry, 83% result in compensation. 17% result in what we call a return to work outcome. Now, a return to work outcome is an outcome where parties have agreed that a person will either be reinstated or reemployed in their position. Now, that's one of the things that we track. So that's why with confidence I can tell you, of all our settlements, 83% result in compensation where somebody has been paid money, so many months, whatever, and in 17% of the cases they have gone back to work in some way or the other. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And then the question you asked us on assisting industries. The first area, in a similar way that we've described how we monitor collective bargaining, we also try and monitor what's going on in relation to companies, and we ask our provincial officers to be alert to any pending retrenchments or anything that's happening. Also in the work that we do with, for example, the trade unions in the province, they would tell us that we might be an issue here, we might contact the employer, etc. So that's how we would identify those issues, or they would come to us in relation to that. But we're trying to get the employment security unit to be more proactive and go out to try and find it so we can intervene before it comes to the CTA, because sometimes when it comes to us, it's almost too late. We want to try and intervene before that case happens. In the course of last year and this year, in the two cases that I can think of quickly, is that in relation to retrenchment, we did 515 large-scale interventions of this nature, and I think the one that everybody will remember was the Anglo-American Platinum process, where there was a consultation in relation to the retrenchment of 14,000 workers, which took considerable time from the CPMA. And we were able to address a lot of the concerns in relation to that and reduce the job losses. In addition to that, significantly on the training layoff scheme in the last year, for those people who come from the Eastern Cape, we assisted in working with the Philippines who were going to have a downtime in relation to the fact that they were retooling their plant in East London to create space for the new C-class Mercedes design. But what that meant is that they were closed down the office of the plant for about 8 months. And while they had made facilities for their existing workforce, the problem was that in the East London area, the whole economy was going to be affected because there are downstream events that happen in relation to that. So about 10 or 12 other companies were identified that they would no longer have work coming in because they wouldn't be having to make the parts that they provide in the East London in relation to that. So the CTMA was able to assist in that and actually intervene and ensure that through the training layoff scheme they were able to support and assist the workers to not actually be retrenched and they could survive the time that the part was down and it's about to come back up now. So that's huge impact was to assist and support and make sure there was no reduction in the economy in East London, just to give an example in relation to that. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, if I might just add to that, seeing here that we have a report that reflects that 38, in the case of 38 companies, in terms of the training layoff, total of 8,826 employees were assisted through that. We don't have names of companies here right now, but I'm sure we can make that available to you. So thank you, Chair.
Chair, this is a matter of interest, but I was going to bring it because we've got the research. We've recently done research on what the CCMA kind of job training activities that it does here, what kind of value does it add to the economy as an entity. And I mean, the outcome is quite interesting and very staggering about how just the small amount of jobs that we save or the big amount that we save, how it impacts on the community and the assistance that we give to the economy and the support of the CCMA in relation to that. But I will be putting that in the next time we come because I think it's very interesting for the members to see that there's value added to the society in addition to the other work. Thank you very much.
There were no further questions. Thank you very much. We have come to the end of our engagement with this committee today. As I said, when you finish the presentation, thank you very much for having come at the last minute and be able to give us some input for us to understand further as to what you are doing in the CMA. And the discussions will be robust now and again, but there's a difference between robust and aggression. And you know, if you come to Parliament, we ask questions. And the questions that we ask in most cases are not questions that you would want questions. And nevertheless, we ask them because for us to be masters of our area of responsibility as members, we must engage you, not rely on the book, but engage and see to it that you are doing your part, because together we will do more, and we are doing more. The meeting stands adjourned. Productivity South Africa and NetLeg are the next. I don't know who comes in the list, but what I feel, I'm told it's not there. Honorable audience, I've adjourned the meeting.
I just want to know when we might come back.
So we can come back at, where is the language here? No, it's here. Then, for a push, for a two up or two. You should be done. You should be done fast. Thank you.